So I think what makes it really strong and enduring is not what it is, but what it doesn't have. And that is the absence of an owner, a greedy owner. That is what happens with every other team. Think about the Bears. The Bears want to move from Chicago to Northern Indiana. Like, that would never happen here.
Hello and welcome to the Dr. Kristen Lierley Show. I'm Dr. Kristen Lierley, and today we're doing something a little bit different. We're talking football, but stick with me because this isn't really a conversation about just football. It's about the people who built, grew, and sustained a community unlike any other in this country and all of the history, politics, and relationships tangled up inside of it. If you live in these parts, you already know the Green Bay Packers aren't just a team. They are practically, I'm using Bob Harlan's words here, a civic religion. And today's guest just wrote the book on it, literally. Tom Nelson is the Outagamie County Executive. He is an author and somebody who has spent years living at the intersection of Wisconsin politics and Wisconsin identity. His brand new book, The Green and Gold Standard, A People's History of the Green Bay Packers, drops September 1st from Triumph Books, and it already has the seal of approval from the late, great Bob Harlan himself, who wrote the foreword. This is not Tom's first book, though. It's his third book, and pre-sales are underway. The pre-season is going. Packer Nation is fired up. There is no better moment for this conversation. Tom, welcome back to the show.
Great to be back on. Thank you for the first kickoff interview for the book tour.
You know that I love you for so many reasons, but one is because you're awesome, and two is because you write these really thoughtful books that seem like they're about one thing, but then there's so much more interwoven into what you're doing. Your last book about the Edmund Fitzgerald wasn't just about the disaster. It was about the people and the failures of our government that created this disaster and cost all of these lives. That's why I'm so excited about this book, because there have been a lot of things written about the Packers, but this one is different. Why?
Well, the story behind how this all came to pass, this was not the original book idea I started with. And I had been pitching this concept, and you touched on this, and this was what drew me to the book project itself, and I think why the Packers have so many fans, not just around here, but around the globe. Mm-hmm. And that is trying to use and explain the Packers' example of how it is organized and how it is run, how it is owned, and how we can replicate that model elsewhere in society, in civic society, in politics, in business, government, and so forth. And I had pitched it to this academic press, and they thought, this is a great idea. We want to do it. And then another press got back to me that also had this early proposal, and they said, this is interesting to be clear, this is interesting, though, but why just write a history in the Packers? It's such a compelling story. I'm like, well, I'm not going to write a book of the Packers about the history because everyone has done it. And he says, actually, no one really has. You've had books about, you know, Lombardi, about Super Bowl I, about these different eras and players and coaches, but there really hasn't been this 1919 to now complete our historical narrative on the team. And sure enough, he was in fact correct. And the result of that was the beginning of this project.
But the project doesn't begin at the beginning. It doesn't begin in 1919. The book actually opens at Janson Elementary School in Combined Locks. Why start there?
Well, this is now my third book, and Combined Locks figures into all three books. So if I write more books, which I hope to do, I'll have to have like Combined Locks in there somehow, no matter what it's about. I mean, if it's about rainforest, I have to do that. It's kind of like Alfred Hitchcock, where he's always in some scene in all his movies. Combined Locks is always in a Tom Nelson book.
That's right. Putting Combined Locks on the map, because a lot of people don't know. It's like, it's in the Fox Valley, heart of the place.
So the reason why I begin there, and it's kind of the heart and soul of the book. So whether it's the Fitzgerald book I wrote or One Day Stronger, there's always a personal connection. And I think people who write about something, of course, have some sort of you know, personal connection. There's a reason why they're writing this book. You know, it has, you know, they have some sort of relationship to, you know, they work there and so forth. And it starts in Jantz Elementary School because that's where my dad started his mission church back in 1980. And the reason why the Nelsons came to the Fox Valley. And at Jantz Elementary School, Sunday mornings, the janitor would open it up. And Steve Vanderloop, he was one of the first people that we met when my family moved here back in 1980. He was a janitor at Jantz Elementary School, and he had Packer season tickets. Wow. And back in the early 1980s, the Packers weren't that good, and this is before Sunday night football, Thursday night football, and the Packers may get on Monday night football every once in a while, and all the games are on Sunday and at noon, which meant mm-hmm. I could never go to a home game because we were in church all morning. Well, 1983 comes along, and the Packers are playing the Redskins, now the Commanders, Monday night, and and Washington is the reigning Super Bowl champion, and we get tickets, and I want to go, and my dad wants me. My mom doesn't because it's a school night, but we still go. And that is one of the most memorable, if not the most memorable, Monday night game, and one of the most memorable games in history, in Packers history. And so that really was the beginning. That was the love affair that really ignited. That was like 7 years old. And so I always remember that. I'm eternally grateful to how Steve Vanderloop brought this into our lives. That has brought so many people together. It's been such an important part of my life and many others. And he's actually one of the co-dedicatees of the book. I dedicate the book to both Steve Vanderloop and then Lee Remmel. And I can get into that later, but that's how it starts out. So thanks for bringing that up. That kind of helps set the stage for this.
Yeah. Well, this is so much more about the people than it is about the Packers. Actually, like the Packers actually just provide the framework, but it's the people. And that's why the subtitle is A People's History. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So here's my question. After spending years with this material, what do you think the fans' ownership structure, because the Packers have over 500,000 shareholders, they don't have a majority owner like everybody else does. What does that do for a community beyond just like the sentiment, like I'm a Packers owner? What does it really mean?
Right. Well, I think that's just it. And I think that is just so powerful that there are other aspects to it, though. But that really is what serves as this cohesive bind. You mentioned, you know, Bob Harlan talking about a civic religion. I mean, that's what it is. It is something that brings everyone together. In the introduction, I make the point about how you have liberals, conservatives, urban, rural, everyone, doesn't matter who it is, like everyone seems to come together. And I think that's very interesting, poignant in Wisconsin, which is the bullseye of swing states. And yes. Northeast Wisconsin is one of Outagamie and Brown County are consistently one of 10 bellwether counties for presidential contests. And so even though we are divided right down the middle, there's this thing called the Green Bay Packers. And it has a lot to do with the ownership structure, but not a lot of people know exactly what that is. So I think what makes it really strong and enduring is not what it is, but what it doesn't have. And that is the absence of an owner, a greedy owner. That is what happens with every other team. Think about the Bears. The Bears want to move from Chicago to Northern Indiana. Like, that would never happen here. And so even though the Bears are almost as old as the Packers, it is the longest running rivalry in the NFL. If we have like the Mikulskis or whoever the owner is and they want to move that, I mean, think about the connection that you currently have to the team. Like, your heart would be broken. Mm-hmm. And that has never happened and it never will. And so it's a solid relationship. You know, you don't have to worry as your spouse, your boyfriend, girlfriend, what are they going to do? No, this is a very strong fidelity and it always has been. And I think that has a lot to do with the magic.
And part of that is growing up with it like you and I did. Part of it, I can't explain. Like, I was in Hawaii for a meeting and I went down for breakfast in the hotel. There was one seat available and I sat down there and the guy next to me was watching the Packer game on his iPad. And I said to him, that's my team. That's my town. And he looked at me and with this strong European accent said, oh, I love the Packers. I have their stock. And as it turns out, he has friends in De Pere, because internationally, apparently, you can't buy the stock. So he has friends in De Pere who bought stock for him. And he gets the NFL ticket in Belgium or wherever he lives so that he can follow, because he loves the feel of the Packers. Otherwise, never had any connection. But there is just something about this sense of community that pulls us together.
So, yeah, that's one of many, and it's all over the world. There's all over the world. When I was doing this, I had a friend send to me a picture of someone wearing a Favre jersey in, I think, Barcelona or someplace. And it really is. There's a website called Packer Fans Everywhere, and it has a list of 1,500 Packer bars. You can go to Tokyo, you can go anywhere and say the term Green Bay Packers. Everyone has heard about it. It is just such a powerful, it's not a brand, it is an institution, a civic religion, in the words of Bob Harlan.
I travel with Packer gear on, and I always anticipate somebody's going to come up to me and give me a high five or knuckles, because that is like, there's that connection. So let's talk about Bob Harlan, because Bob Harlan wrote your foreword. Bob Harlan, longtime Green Bay Packer president. This was really the last thing he did before he passed in March. Wow, Tom, how did that all come together?
Well, first of all, his passing is a major loss for the area, for the NFL, for the Packers diaspora. He is the reason why the Packers, I believe, are still in Green Bay. It's a reason why I have named the modern era the Harlan era. So you've got the Lambeau era, the Lombardi era, and the Harlan era that goes back to approximately 1991, 1992. And he is as kind and generous as he seems from television. I tracked him down because I had a subscription to Spokio, and I had left a message at his house. He didn't get it, but his son Mike Harlan did, and passed along to his dad, who was in Florida or someplace wherever they were wintering, and he called me back. He says, Tom Nelson, this is Bob Harlan from the Green Bay Packers. Yes, I'm quite aware of who Bob Harlan is. And I asked him if I could interview him. He said yes. We spoke for about an hour. And then when the book came together, I'm thinking it'd be nice to have a foreword. So Bob agreed to do the foreword, and and why not call him? So I called him. He said right away, yes, absolutely. I sent him a draft, the latest draft at that point, so he wanted, you know, because I wasn't going to ask him just like write something sight unseen. So he read it, and I still have this voicemail message in my phone. I will never erase it. And he has said, Tom Nelson, Bob Harlan here. Fantastic. I just want to say this was one of the best Packer books. I think you've done just a supremely fantastic, you know, just a terrific job. And, you know, I called him back and I'm talking to him and he's saying the same thing. And then all of a sudden I hear another voice, and it's his wife, Madeline, who picked up the phone. You know how, like, when you call like your grandparents, they have like you're calling a landline and they're, you know, one's in the bedroom, one's in the living room, they're talking to you. And Madeline says, you know, Tom, I just want to say that this was an excellent book and thank you so much for doing that. So I don't know if they are always very happy, generous people, though, but it's something that meant the world to me. And so he wrote this foreword and it leads off the book.
It sounds like it meant the world to him, too. Let's talk about another Packer legend, Reggie White. I had no idea when Reggie White, because I wasn't that into like the mechanics, you know, he was just an icon to me. But you write that Reggie White became the named face of the players' fight for free agency, basically the NFL's version of a landmark rights case. Was there a moment when you were writing that chapter when you saw him less as a Hall of Fame pass rusher and more as a legal figure who changed the league's entire economic structure, essentially?
Yeah, I would say he is, I mean, he was close to not just a labor figure, but a leader in general. And I think if you asked him today, if you talked to his family, you know, football player, figurehead, leader, I think that they would say leader. He was a leader because he was a pastor. He was a leader because he was captain of I think, two teams plus the USFL. And he was the tip of the spear in the 1993 settlement and case that brought both free agency, limited free agency, and also salary caps. And that, of course, was very important for small market teams like the Packers to have that structure to balance out the shared revenue or to augment the shared revenue. So, he was the face, that he was a figure. And during the 1987 strike, he was in the NFL. He was playing for the Philadelphia Eagles, and he actually put himself in front of a bus to stop replacement players. This is someone who, you know, knew what he believed in it, and he lived it. He lived it to a T, and he did not apologize. He was the genuine article. He was the real deal.
We all loved Reggie White. Do you know about the area code?
Yes, 920. Yep, 920.
Because it was back in the day. We were 414 up here.
Yep.
But it was soon after Reggie White had, I think, retired that we had to change area codes. And
I would not have been surprised if that was the reason why they did that. I don't know who comes up with making the changes for the area code, though. But it's like, you know, don't dial 414 anymore. Think of Reggie Wright. Dial 920. Because it was like sometime in 95 or 96, you know, when it was peak Packers time.
Yes. Well, in the olden days, everybody had dials, so they wanted the short numbers because they were easier.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But, you know, with the buttons, it's different. 920. Every time I see our area code, I think of Reggie White. It's kind of neat.
Yeah, it is.
So research. Let's talk about how you researched this. In your note on sources, you lay out a strict hierarchy. First-hand accounts first, then the primary documents, then the experts, then the secondary sources. And you say that you discounted other Packers books that had factual errors. You are precise and you write truthful, honest books. So was there a moment when that rigor forced you to cut a story that you really wanted to be true?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad you brought that up, because there was a story about Johnny Blood McNally, but there was also another one that I never found in a book. It was mentioned in some article or maybe on a blog. And that was in the 1986 game in Chicago when Jim McMahon was body slammed. And that was like the nadir of the Green Bay Packers. I mean, it was ugly. It was a bad name. Charles Taylor, or Charles Martin, I forgot. Charles Martin, he was suspended for two games, which was the most severe penalty Pete Rozelle ever levied on a player. And evidently, after the game, Brian Noble went over to the Bears locker room and apologized on behalf of Charles Martin and the team and their behavior and so forth. And I thought that is something that Brian Noble would absolutely have done. He was a class act. So I called around, I searched, I did everything, and I couldn't find confirmation about that. So that's an example. And, you know, it wasn't really until Cliff Crystal, who is the team historian, who was also a reporter for a long time for the Press Gazette, for the Journal Sentinel, and he wrote this 4-page encyclopedia set. And what was important about this is up until that point, there was never a standard. There was never this standard that took the Packers the entire history, like factually, year by year, very authoritatively. And so I think that's part of the reason why there hadn't been a lot of books that had a really good factual basis, just because there wasn't a lot of material out there. And what I did in this book, when you talk about firsthand accounts, a lot of it was in the early days, a guy by the name of George Calhoun, and he was a co-founder along with Lambeau. And so Lambeau was the one who played, he put the people together, he recruited, he got the schedule set up. But then George Calhoun, who was an editor at the Green Bay Press Gazette, he did the promotional and the PR. He was the one who ginned up the news. He's the one who made calls to other NFL teams to support the Packers coming to play there. So he did double duty. He was writing articles about the Packers for the Press Gazette, and he was also doing promotional work for the team that he co-founded. So I relied a lot on George Calhoun, but in this case, you kind of had a conflict of interest where the guy who's doing the PR is doing the covering. So I had to check a lot of that against the NFL records to make sure that those things lined up. And there was no reason for him to lie. He didn't, but I think just as a practice, when you see a possible conflict there, you need to check multiple sources. And that's the reason why I did first, firsthand accounts, and then looking at other primary source material. And that was very important in telling the story in the early years because it was long ago. There wasn't a lot of books written on that. So I relied a lot on articles, on interviews, things like that. But that's also the formative years, going through the 1920s, struggling through a stock sale there, going through the 1930s through another one, losing Lambeau, and doing another, a third stock issuance in 1950. So it was very, very important to get those early decades right because it creates the narrative foundation to go on and talk about the 1950s, the Lombardi era, the 1980s, and so forth.
Knowing all of the different pieces that you pull into this story, how you weave it all together, did you ever find yourself going down a rabbit hole and then just having to stop and refocus so that you could get this project done?
Well, it's kind of funny how this works. And since you've run for office before running for the assembly, when you're knocking on doors and you're really drilling into it, and you're wondering, like, how long should I keep knocking on doors? Well, it's not election day, so you have to keep going, though. But at some point, you start hearing your buzz, right? You'll be at a grocery store and they'll be like, oh, yeah, you came to my door. And so you kind of see your name recognition, but it's repeating. And so in research, you'll get a critical mass where you'll read a story one place and then another place, and then you realize, okay, I've gone all the way down that I need to tell this. If I'm telling this complete arc narrative, I'm only going to be able to go so far down. And there was just so many interesting subplots and personalities and games that you never really wanted to go too far because it would take away from the next season or the next draft and so forth. So it's not like, I think sometimes for biographies, people write, you have someone who's very interesting, but they're only very interesting for one part of their life. And you got to kind of go through the slog, get through the early years and getting to formative stage and so forth. But with the Packers, I mean, it was a compelling drama with compelling characters all the way from 1919 to now.
It takes an author with discipline, Tom. That's you.
Thank you.
Let's talk about The Reckoning. The chapter titled Reckoning opens just 4 days after a Super Bowl win with Scott Walker and Act 10 politically tearing Wisconsin apart. So we had this big joyous occasion and then this really troubling occasion just 2.5 hours south of this. Why does this football team, the Green Bay Packers, hold our state together in a tense political environment, really, that's been happening since that time? It is the thing that we set everything aside and unify over every Sunday or Wednesday or Tuesday or Thursday or Friday.
I think it's a really good example that animates why the Packers are so special. It helps explain why it keeps us together, but above all, it is so important. And I think when Bob Harlan talks about a civic religion, to have an aspect of our day-to-day life, of civil society that brings us together. I mean, imagine if we didn't have the Packers, how much more we were at our throats. You know, you go to a family gathering, what do you talk about? Politics? No, we can't talk about that. Weather, only so long. We can talk about the Packers.
All day long.
And so, right. So many aspects of life and facets, the Packers can come up. But, you know, juxtaposed with winning the Super Bowl and then a couple of days later, for those that remember the Act 10 protest, then Governor Scott Walker talked about how he was going to drop the bond, which was Act 10 that would strip collective bargaining rights for almost all public sector unions. There were huge protests that within a couple of days of the announced legislation that were peaking at 100,000 or so. And that was right after this joyous moment. So it seemed, I mean, it was just really surreal. Like, we went from, you know, brothers in arms, this is up, to like, okay, it's back to war, you know. But, you know, things came back together. We got through that. It was very, very tumultuous. But that's the reason why I opened up that chapter, because I thought that was a really good way to juxtapose the two phenomenon. The Packers, that brings community together, and politics that sometimes too often divides us.
The energy, though, was kind of similar in many ways. We were living in Madison at the time, and we brought the kids down to the Act 10 protests, and they were peaceful, and we were walking around the Capitol, going inside. People had drums. There were so many people everywhere. But it was still that sense of, we are here together to do good for our state. And the Packers have that same kind of energy.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yes. And it was a perfect, I mean, it really was a good antidote to that, antidote, because if you want to somehow fill the vacuum, we are going to family gatherings, you're going to the water cooler at work, you're going to be walking the dog. There has to be something. There has to be something. We can't just like stare at each other or stare at each other and get really angry. We need to have something to bring us together. And that's what the Packers do. And so it's not something that is so enjoyable to look forward to in the fall on Sundays or Mondays, Thursdays, but also something that takes us throughout the year. And we know that the Packers figure prominently in our lives year round. Open the newspaper, and you have not weekly, you know, day by day coverage of the Packers during the NFL season, but year round. I don't think, I mean, you have to go back, I don't know, decades when there was a single day when there was not a single Packer story in a sports section in the Press Gazette or Post Crescent.
Yeah, it is core to not just our need for sports around here, but it is our economy. It is our culture.
It is.
Especially in Green Bay, but really all across Northeast Wisconsin, and all of Wisconsin buys into it. So incredibly important. We talked about the Packers pulling people together, being political, how complex that is. Let's talk about the players. You note that Aaron Rodgers was one of the most outspoken NFL quarterbacks when he defended Colin Kaepernick's right to protest, and that he directed the team's social justice giving toward legal action of Wisconsin. What does that chapter say about athletes and political speech, especially in these challenging times?
So I forgot, is that the last chapter or second to last chapter? Because second to last chapter is called, okay, so let's put them together. So Redemption is chapter 12, and it's called Redemption because Aaron Rodgers was in Brett Favre's shadow from 2005 to 2008. There's a lot of controversy in summer 2008, whether or not Favre would come back or not. The fans were of one mind, and the front office, namely Ted Thompson, was of a different mind. Ted Thompson prevailed over popular opinion, and we are so much better off because of what Ted Thompson did. But it's called Redemption because 2 years later, or after three seasons, Aaron Rodgers is in the Super Bowl. And even though for me the exciting seasons were in the 1990s, and I remember all these comebacks with Favre, and it's just, I love those games. It is my favorite era far and away. But looking at the numbers, which is everything, you know, Aaron Rodgers was by the numbers the best was the best quarterback in Packers history. With comebacks, win-loss, with his passer rating. And I spent a lot of time talking about him, but he was a really interesting character.
Still is.
And very multidimensional. And I thought how he stood up for Colin Kaepernick. And that, I mean, he was radioactive, you know, still is. There were very, very few people. And like Reggie White, you know, believed in what he believed, and he lived things. And the same thing with Aaron Rodgers in that respect. So in that way, I saw a lot of Reggie White in Aaron Rodgers, because Reggie White took very controversial positions when he was leading the NFL, when he put his name on the lawsuit, when he secured free agency for workers, when he sustained small market teams like the Packers with salary caps. This is something that Aaron Rodgers felt very deeply about. And he knew going out there, talking about Colin Kaepernick in a positive light was something that not everyone was going to like. And it really took guts.
Yeah, I don't think Aaron Rodgers really cares what other people think.
No, he doesn't. No. And that's what makes him very multidimensional. I mean, he is not one political shade. He is all over. And say what you will about him, he's someone that's doing it because he believes in that. And he knows that when, even though you are someone who is very well known, whose livelihood is dependent on your public persona, and that every time you make a controversial comment or stake out a controversial issue, your capital falls that much. And so some players and some people in general are kind of sloppy about that, but then some people kind of think about this, look, I know that I'm putting my name at risk. This is not going to really help me though, but I believe in this issue. And you have to credit him for that.
Yeah, that's character. For sure, whether you agree or not. Mm-hmm. I'm going to say three names, and then I'm going to ask you about Succession. Wolf, Thompson, Gutekunst. Favre, Rodgers, Love. Now we've got Micah Parsons. Does Green Bay just get lucky with this? Like, when you look at how many quarterbacks the Bears have had versus how many quarterbacks we've had, it is kind of crazy that we've had so much consistency and success.
I would think, so going backwards, Love. This was an instance, one of the unsung heroes in the front office, the Packers, is a guy by the name of Sam Seal. And he played for the Raiders under Ron Wolf back in the 80s, and he became a scout. And Ron Wolf hired him as a scout. He went from junior position to the West Coast and then staying back in Green Bay. But he was the person that saw Aaron Rodgers, that saw Jordan Love, that, you know, once from Utah, once from California. And so that was part of his area. And in both of those instances, he says, you know, Aaron Rodgers, he started out slow, started community college, but look, this guy's the real deal. Cal Berkeley had a good program, but it wasn't like top tier SEC. So he wasn't really getting a lot. And then you have Utah State for Jordan Love. And those are two examples of how, you know, we didn't get lucky in the sense that we had good staff. We've consistently had good staff because of the culture. People want to play for the Packers. People want to work for the Packers. And that's a really good example about how, you know, Sam Seal, who's putting thousands of miles on his car on the West Coast, he sees someone says, you know, we need to invest on him. And credit Ron Wolf and the front office following Bob Harlan. And Bob Harlan took over. He said, look, Ron Wolf, I'm going to let you do whatever you want to do, okay? And that was a mistake that the Packers had made before, and that the executive board that didn't have any political, that didn't have any sports experience, that was micromanaging things, which is a big reason why they didn't do well in the 1970s and the 1980s. So Sam Seal presents solid cases. Now, where the Packers did get lucky was in 2005 with Ted Thompson. Aaron Rodgers was supposed to go early. And then one by one, he sat there in the green room. And, you know, further on, I mean, there was like maybe a, you know, pick 12 or 13. Ted Thompson decided this is the guy we want. There weren't, I think they had needs in defense in the defensive line, but they really didn't have a lot of good players at that position. And so he had made a decision midway through that first round that he was going to take him and that this was going to be the successor to Brett Favre. He got lucky because he didn't trade up, and he happened to be there. Aaron Rodgers happened to be there at the very end. So I would say that was, you know, ice in the veins. You got to say he kind of got lucky with that. And then going back to Brett Favre, he was overlooked, but he's someone that Ron Wolf had his eye on, Mike Holmgren had his eye on, a lot of people. He came out of the class in 1991, and there really weren't a lot of big names. And he came from a small program. But Ron Wolf knew a good quarterback, and that was really Ron Wolf's signature, is when he was drafting, if there's a good quarterback on the board, you draft him. And so that's the reason why there are about a half a dozen quarterbacks that he drafted in the 1990s that went on to start for other NFL teams. So Ron Wolf put a lot of thought into Brett Favre, and when it came available, he told Bob Harlan, the first decision I make is a very controversial one. I'm going for this no-name guy named Brett Favre. And Bob Harlan, he could have said, okay, I'm sorry, I didn't mean that. You can't do that. Nobody wants to do that. But he stuck to his guns, and he let Ron Wolf make that very consequential trade.
So it's not luck, it's leadership and smarts. That's what I hear.
Yeah.
Saying.
Yeah. I think it's some kismet, and I think it's just, you know, being there at the right, but you know, that's how it is for everything in life. I mean, not every single major occurrence or good thing that happens is strictly because someone made the right decision. There's a lot of things that kind of line up. A really good example is the Democratic primary for governor. You could never have thought about that. And David ran a very good campaign, but if you kind of go backwards, there were a lot of things that were way beyond his control, way beyond most people's control, that really had to go right. But you still give, in this case, David credit for winning the nomination, just like you give credit to Ted Thompson, to Ron Wolf, and to everyone for making these brilliant decisions.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of brilliant decisions, the brilliant decision of the Packers early on to be a team owned by the community is something no other NFL team can do, because the NFL actually banned it.
Yes.
So what does it say? That the most successful version of a sports franchise is the one that the industry made sure could never happen again.
Well, that really confirms what we all know, which is these pro sports leagues, they're about money. Mm-hmm. The NFL generates about $22, $23 billion worth of revenue every year. If every team were to sell overnight, there would be a transaction of $250 billion. So this is big, big business. So of course this clatch of billionaires, you know, they don't want to like leave any money on the table. And that's what the Packers are doing. The Packers are worth like $8 billion and no one is making money off of them. And they look at that and that is just wrong. I can tell you, no matter what they say in public, people like Jerry Jones or the Glazers in Tampa Bay, they do not like the Packers for that reason. And mm-hmm. So the proof is in the pudding. They grandfathered the Packers. They tried to disrupt this organizational structure many times, especially in the early years, and the Packers stuck to their guns. They went up against almost insurmountable odds, whether it was bankruptcy, whether it was receivership, whether it was the NFL working with the city fathers and mothers of Milwaukee trying to bring the Packers down there. It's just amazing. So it's not just a story of how the people came together, persevered, and won, but it is really getting knocked down and standing up and fighting and doing it again. Even though there was always an easy out to sell, they never did it. That would have been an easy way out. 9 times out of 10, they probably would have, or somebody else would. So the deeper you go into the story, the more appreciation you have for really what this team means. And I was attracted to this, not because I'm this mega sports fan, I love the Packers, but how this civic religion, what this is in the context of our society, of what makes the state so special, that's what drew me to this topic.
It's the Packers, it's the sports, it's the leadership. Is it socialism, Tom? Are the Green Bay Packers an example of socialism?
Well, let's put it this way. If you look at how the NFL runs, it runs more like a democratic socialist economy in Scandinavia than any other industry in a capitalist system. I mean, no one has this, that they have shared revenue. Think about that. It's a redistributive economic scheme. So it's very unique, and you can see those overt themes. And that's not just a conclusion I'm making. That's just what is happening. No other industry has that type of arrangement than within the NFL. So in that respect, it's not just the NFL has this outlier, this nonprofit corporation, but everyone, whether you have a team in New York or Buffalo or Los Angeles or Green Bay, it's you add up all the TV revenue and other aspects of the shared revenue formula, and you divide it evenly among 32 teams, and that's how much money you get. Nowhere else in this country do you have a setup like that.
Yeah, it is great for the city of Green Bay, for the team, for us, for the fans. In the epilogue, you write about how the team has kind of, as you were writing this, the team kind of mirrored your own journey as a Packer fan in the 80s and the 90s coming of age. I was one of those kids too. Like, you just knew as a kid that you were a Packer fan the same way that you were a Wisconsinite or you were a member of your family. It was just that core to who we are. So was there a point as you were writing this book where it stopped being about the team and it started being a little bit about you?
I think it started that way. I've always, I look back at my life and just how fortunate, how blessed I've had, been to grow up in a community like this, to live in a community like this, to have such a loving family. And this is one aspect. This is the manifestation of the relationship I had with my dad, with my cousins, with friends, neighbors, and so forth. And so these are really special times. And so, of course, I'm not spending 13 chapters talking about Tom Nelson, the 1980s, but it's a jumping off point. And I use this story to, I mean, I use the subject, the Packers, to tell a bigger story that when I read it, it helps explain some aspects of my life. And I know that other people are going to read this, and hopefully they finish reading and they're going to say, ah, now I get it. This is why the Packers are so special. But it also explains to them why, what it is about the Packers that really drew them in the first place. And maybe it animates a time in their childhood when they went to a Monday night game, or maybe it was a tailgate party. You know, it's absolutely endless. But as I mentioned, the epilogue, part of it, I look at the Packers, the 1980s. You know, the Packers were coming of age in the 1990s, or sorry, in the 1980s, the Packers were growing up. 1990s, they were coming of age. Same thing, 1980s, I'm growing up, 1990s, college, early years, and so forth. So that's how those track. And so it begins this early experience, and then it ends looking back at, okay, now this makes sense. I first learned about the Packers in 1983, and then looking back, well, the 1980s were growing up years for the Packers, just like they were growing up years for Tom Nelson, and things were taking hold, coming of age in the 1990s, same thing with me. And so that's another example why it makes this so special.
And we can look forward to that Tom Nelson autobiography yet to come. Not yet on the books.
No, not in the books. That is, no, I will find 100 other interesting things to write on before that.
Now, you're about to embark on a book tour. How can people find the Green and Gold Standard online, in books? Where are you going to be?
They can, your nearest bookstore. I've reached out to many. Triumph Books, which is publishing it. They've done so too, so that will be on the stock, that will be stocked and on the shelf September 1st. Of course, you can always go to Amazon, Triumph Books, and their website has a copy too. So all kinds of, if you just go and type in Green and Gold, Green and Gold Standard, Tom Nelson, People's History, you'll find 20 different options to do it. My first, I will kick in off on September 1st in Green Bay at Lion's Mouth, then going down to Boswell's in Milwaukee on the 2nd, and we'll be hitting about 7 or 8 stops in that first week, and then I'll come out with more dates later in September, October, and into November. So there are talks and so forth, but if we haven't firmed up dates or anything. So if you want to follow it, go to my Facebook page, Nelson4WI. We'll be giving updates in that way. But getting hold of the book, pretty simple. Go to Amazon, do a search. Better yet, this is the best thing, is if you go to your local bookstore and then say, I would like to order this book, what they're going to do is they're not just going to get one. They're going to get 4 or 5. And I'll tell you what, once a book gets on the shelf and starts selling, it will always be there.
That's right, especially in a place like Green Bay, Lion's Mouth, downtown, like to support our independent booksellers. Yes. Tom Nelson, thank you for writing this book. Thank you for chatting today. I cannot wait to read it. I didn't get my copy until this morning, so I haven't had a chance to go through all of it. So I am like, I've got the PDF all queued up.
Wonderful. And I'll send you a hard copy too. It's in the mail.
Excellent.
Tomorrow morning. It's in the mail. Well,
perfect. And I'll have all of the links in the show notes. So friends, they will be there for you. If you enjoyed our conversation, please do give it a like, drop a comment, share it with a fellow Packer fan, and make sure you're subscribed and have that bell turned on so you'd never miss an episode. Thanks for joining us.